May 1979. British nurse Helen Smith, 23, is found dead after a party at a colleague's home in the city of Jeddah, Saudi Arabia. The notoriously strict kingdom sentences other guests to lashings for breaking Islamic law and mark Helen's death as an accident. But Helen's father doesn't accept the official narrative. Ron Smith would wage a decades-long fight in both Britain and Saudi Arabia to find the truth about what happened to his daughter. Sources for this episode include The Guardian, The BBC, The Yorkshire Post, Arab News, The Telegraph, Four Corners, and Amnesty International. Hi guys, welcome back to episode 93 of Unknown Passage, a podcast that tells the stories of those who have gone missing or have been murdered abroad. So I thought I'd bring you another episode this week, and later on in the week I'll also be dropping you another bonus episode that I hope you'll find pretty interesting, because feeling pretty good and I have a number of Patreon location requests to get through. So I've been doing like a ton of reading and I thought I'd bring you the newest episode early. So I don't really have anything else to say before I get into it. And so I'll probably just get straight into it because this case is quite detailed. There's a lot to go through in terms of the place we'll be going to. And there's a lot to kind of talk about in terms of what could have happened here, because this is the first real mystery we'll be going through in quite a while. So at the end, I'll be going through different theories and things like that. So this is a location request for patron Paul, who is a Scot. So I love him already, who grew up on the west coast of Scotland, and he lives in London now. So Paul requested a number of different countries and said to choose one, and most of them were in like the Arab Gulf area of the world. So I immediately picked Saudi Arabia from his choices because I hoped that someone at some point would choose this place, because it's very controversial and I have a lot to say on it. So we will be going to a place I'll probably be the hardest on. So chill if you're easily offended, because there's a lot for me to be offended about this place and it gives me a lot to talk about. So when I chose Saudi from his choices, I remembered a case that years ago I read about, and all I knew was that it was a foreign nurse who was working there, because quite a lot of expats worked there at the time, and someone got impaled in this story. So when I looked for it, I actually found this case that came up called Yvonne Guilford. And when I read it, I was like, that's not the one. But it turns out that there is another nurse who was Australian who was murdered around the same time in Saudi Arabia. And I'm trying to get a hold of a book about her. So I was going to do a double-parter on this with Helen and Yvonne's stories, but I'm trying to get Yvonne's book because it's out of print and I really want to read it because there's just not enough out there about it. So in short, two very similar cases, but for this one, I'm talking about a British nurse called Helen Smith, who died in very strange circumstances in the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. Now, like many cases we've done before, this is also a case of a father's determination to get answers as to why his daughter died. And I feel like we've seen that, you know, a million times. Generally, fathers with daughters. Brings me back to Alison MacDonald, who went missing in Kashmir, and her father Kenny. But Ron was not without his faults, the father of Helen Smith. So he's quite a central figure in this case. Ron's campaigning actually led to major changes in the law in Britain, and those revolve around Britons who have died abroad, which we will get into. So one of the best sources for this, or there's two actually, for this case were actually, I find that going back to articles that were written close to the time something happened is the best way to get to the actual truth of the matter. And I found two that are actually in archives online. So one was a few years later, from 1982, written for Maclean's, and it's called Sex and Death in the Desert by Edward Daly. There's also one called Death in Jeddah for Marxism Today from 1983, which actually filled in a lot of gaps for me. But Helen's case continues to get media coverage even to this day, or at least it did until her father died about 10 years ago. And I guess he was the one really pushing for answers. So I guess all that has left you gagging for more information. So let's first talk about who Helen Smith was. Helen Linda Smith was born on January the 3rd, 1956 in Yorkshire. No source says exactly where, but I believe it was West Yorkshire, probably Leeds, because that's where a lot of, you know, people in her family lived. Her father lived there until his death 10 years ago, and she is also buried in West Yorkshire on... Well, I'll get into that. So she was 23 when she died, and she at the time was working abroad in Saudi Arabia as a nurse. And back in the day, there was a big push for a lot of nurses to actually go and work there, and they were kind of fed. I've actually know quite a lot about this, and a lot of them were really fed a lie about the conditions they'd be living in and the conditions of this country, which we will get into. So growing up, Helen loved spending time outdoors, and she loved spending time and having picnics with her family on the Yorkshire Moors, which, you know, are the big kind of hilly moors. I don't know how to describe it. And her favourite one was Ilkley Moor, which is in West Yorkshire. Now, her parents were Gerald, that's her mum, and Ron, her dad, and Helen was the oldest of four siblings. Her younger siblings are Graham, David, and Beverly, who are all still alive today. Her dad, Ron, was a policeman as she was growing up, and her parents split up when Helen was about 21, about a year before she moved to Saudi Arabia. Ron was violent, and he's kind of owned up to that. Their breakup was so bad, and Helen's death would ultimately make it worse. Gerald would describe the decades after Helen's death as quote-unquote venom from Ron. Gerald ultimately said she left Ron with just the clothes on her back. I presume she waited until all her kids were grown up so she could leave, and Ron would later admit to breaking Gerald's nose when they were together. He would harbour tons of hate towards her, which was pretty evident for decades. And Gerald really believed that this was because she ultimately ended up marrying another man, and Ron always kind of held on to that. All of the children were estranged from Ron by the time Helen died, although I'm not sure. I don't think Helen was. And they basically were up until about 12 years ago, actually. So pretty much their entire lives for how he treated their mum. But Ron is a bit of a redeemable character in this whole story, which you'll realise. I don't know the ins and outs of Helen's life. So she grew up in the 60s and 70s, so it's not like she had social media or anything like that. But I do know that at 23, Helen had taken a job as a nurse in the very elusive Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. She actually wanted to be a police officer like her dad, but she actually failed the exams to become one. So she turned to nursing instead. And back in the day, a lot of you will remember that it wasn't often like a course at a university or anything. You often trained on the job as a nurse. There's one really, really only one picture of Helen that's out there that's used again and again. She's got like a short dark brown bob, and she's wearing like her nurse's uniform because she initially worked in South London at St. George's Hospital, and then she transferred up to St. James's Hospital in Leeds in 1977. And by the following year, she was heading out to Saudi Arabia to work there they would pay them quite well. As I said, there was quite an international push for skilled people like nurses to work abroad in Saudi, even up until like now. And I do remember one guy on Locked Up Abroad who took a job there and ultimately would be done, you know, by the religious police for being gay and meeting up with another guy. And he kind of talked about how these brochures that they would be given about where they'd be living in these massive villas and how amazing it would be. When they got there, it was not the reality of what happened. Often they were sold on a lie on the lifestyle that they'd enjoy there and the accommodation. And I will say that at the time that Helen moved to Saudi Arabia, even though things have quote unquote changed a little bit in the last couple of years, expectations were that expats there would conduct themselves the same as women in Saudi Arabia, which says a lot. So this is where I'm going to talk quite a lot about the place that is Saudi Arabia. So, Saudi Arabia is a country in West Asia, but it is the Middle East, and it's officially known as the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. It sits on the Arabian Peninsula, and it's the largest country in the Middle East and the second largest in the entire Arab world. And it's massive. It is bordered, so Jordan and Iraq are at its north, Kuwait is to the northeast, Qatar, Bahrain and the United Arab Emirates, so like Dubai and Abu Dhabi, are to its east. Oman is to the southeast, and Yemen is to the south. And it's separated from Egypt and Israel, which are in its northwest by a gulf. So 35 million people currently call Saudi Arabia home. And like a lot of places, it has one of the world's youngest populations. So, about 50% of the population of Saudi Arabia are under 25 years old. And I will get into how they kind of conduct themselves with the education system for young people. The capital is Riyadh, and Saudi Arabia is one of the most secretive countries in the world. Only just in 2019 could tourists actually get a tourist visa for there, and journalists there just don't exist. It's just not a job that you have there. And if you want to be a journalist from outside going in to cover it, you just can't. You pretty much would have to have like a hidden camera, and even then, they'd probably find it. If you're caught reporting on life here, you'll spend time in prison. Saudi Arabia has gotten away with a lot of what they do, in regards to pretty much human rights abuses, due to money. Money talks in Saudi Arabia and to the rest of the world, and it's often considered like a middle power in terms of the world economy. The Saudi economy is the largest in the Middle East and the 19th largest in the world. And obviously, its oil industry is huge, and its oil industry is worth about 7 trillion British pounds. The country very much likes the rest of the world to see, much like the United Arab Emirates, that it's glittering and ostentatious and amazing, and very wealthy, but that's really not the reality of what's going on inside. A quarter of its population live in poverty. And when I get into how the country operates under Sharia law, you'll see just how kind of despicable it is that it's gotten away with what it has for ages. And unfortunately, a lot of the countries that you, me, other listeners live in, kind of ally itself with this place. So, just a couple of years ago, there was quite a lot of celebrities that went to Saudi Arabia to promote its tourism. And one of them was Armie Hammer, and it still has pictures on his on his Instagram. And you should just see the comments from people like on the Instagram, because like these celebrities are so dumb. They would just think of like the almighty dollar that they're getting paid. And when I get into kind of how people are treated there, you'll see why it's a like disgusting thing. But they needed like celebrities to promote tourism because tourist visas only became a thing in 2019. So these celebrities were taken there, but obviously kept away from the reality of what's going on. So they were just taken on camera rides and all this crap. I know recently David Beckham signed like a deal with some brand that's in this part of the world. He obviously has like a low IQ. Like, I think that's pretty obvious to anyone who has heard him speak for like more than 2 seconds, but he got a lot of hate too. But these people, like, money is the only, like, it's like, it's just the driver in their lives. At least, like, I could just can't imagine any of them just Googling for 2 seconds Saudi Arabia and what goes on there. And it also seems like international publications like Insider are on the Saudi take as well, because I found an article that wrote when tourist visas were released in 2019, quote, "The country is full of wonder with 5 pristine UNESCO heritage sites, Red Sea beach resorts, and futuristic cities like Riyadh," unquote. So I'm not going to mince words about Saudi Arabia. I kind of wanted to do this place, and I'm glad that Paul requested it, because you thought I was hard on Iran, but I was only just warming up with that one. We have never been to a place on this podcast that is so medieval, backwards, and horrible, and just an overall shithole like Saudi Arabia. And I know quite a lot about Saudi Arabia before I researched Helen's case, and I watched quite a lot of stuff in the lead up to recording this to refresh my memory. And I watched a documentary called Saudi Arabia Uncovered that I will put on the episode page on unknownpassagepodcast.com. So in it, a young journalist goes undercover to Saudi Arabia to film the reality of how people live there. You can't film anything openly there because they don't want the rest of the world to see what's really going on. So he risked prison by doing that, and he was caught, you know, in a day of being there, and the police bashed him. So I'm just going to play you the beginning of that, because the first like couple minute or so, they just kind of list the various things that are wrong with this place and how the rest of the world just kind of turns a blind eye.
There is a state which beheads and even crucifies its citizens, where those who question its authority are lashed and locked up for years. A state where women lack many basic rights, patrolled by religious police, where children are indoctrinated, but this is not the Islamic State. This is the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. A close ally which buys billions of pounds worth of British arms, whose security forces we equip and train, even though they're in conflict with many of their own people. Whose oil we buy, and whose royals get the red carpet treatment.
We have a relationship with Saudi Arabia because we receive from them important intelligence and security information that keep us safe.
Working with a team of Saudi undercover cameramen,
watch this.
This film sets out to penetrate one of the world's most secretive and repressive states.
The women, they're imprisoned. They just fear freedom.
Because of American and European support to the Saudi monarchy, our people have suffered.
And we will uncover how Saudi money and ideology has helped drive terrorism around the world.
I think there's a very real threat that the ideology that comes from there is posing to us. Morally, we need to make a stand. I think that the chickens are coming home to roost on this one.
So I really recommend watching it. It's on the Real Stories page. It's got quite a few million views. It's really scary. Even just the opening part with the clips that they're playing, just men bashing women in stores, bashing a woman to death. This is a country that literally still crucifies people, just in case you thought that that ended a couple of thousand years ago. And it tortures anyone who really questions the state. They operate under the most strict code of Islam in Saudi Arabia. So since 2015, there was the new crown prince. His name's Mohammed bin Salman. You may know his name. He was one of the youngest like world leaders to ever come in. I think he was like late 20s. So he vowed to improve things in the country, including women's rights, banning child marriage, removing anti-Semitic and misogynistic passages in school education, pushing the codification of the legal system, reduction in the use of capital punishment, as well as actually protecting migrant workers. So when I get into this, you'll realize that really since then, things are actually got worse in a lot of ways. So whether or not you believe him. So he thinks that allowing women to drive a car is fixing everything. So the documentary shows women begging with this undercover camera, as a lot of them at the time it was filmed can't have jobs. Now they kind of can, as long as a man signs off on it, as we'll get into. I also watched a Four Corners documentary on women in Saudi Arabia by ABC News Australia, and it follows, you may remember that girl, her name's Rahaf. She escaped Saudi Arabia a few years ago and she took refuge in the Bangkok airport. You may remember it. It was quite a big story. Ultimately, she was granted asylum in Canada, and it follows her story and why women want to leave Saudi Arabia because of what they do to them there. And I just remembered what an amazing girl Rahaf is. So wherever she is, I hope she's doing well. So women have to completely cover themselves up. Some of them show their faces now, but most of the time they cover their faces as well. Women must be accompanied everywhere by men. And this man, they must either, it's usually their father, and if they're married, it's their husband. So this is called the Saudi Male Guardianship Program. And women are reliant on men to keep them alive, and they are often homeless. They cannot drive until about 18 months ago, women were allowed to start getting licenses, but they still have to drive around with men. So it really, just these tiny little changes are just a smokescreen. They cannot travel without permission from the men. They cannot attend gyms. They cannot get a higher education. And they are controlled from birth until death. And in that documentary from Four Corners, they talk about how it is classified as gender apartheid. In the first documentary I talked about, it shows women being screamed at men in the street for things like wearing makeup, being kicked by men, bashed by men, and stoned to death by men. Women's shelters that do exist there are actually technically prisons, and once you go there for help, they won't let you go. Women who approach police for help from the men who abuse them are told that they cannot make a complaint unless their male guardian is with them, and the male guardian is usually the abuser. So you can see how life there is just really organized so that men... There's a documentary on YouTube called Do Arab Men Hate Women? And I'll leave that question with you, but I think that, you know, the indoctrination there is real from a very young age. The Saudis actually think that they are so powerful now that they are trying to enforce their own male guardianship laws outside of Saudi Arabia. Like, if women happen to escape and leave, they've been known to, like, stalk them and, like, you know, try to enforce their laws in other countries. Religious police patrol the streets in Saudi Arabia, hoping to find people who are breaking their endless list of moral laws that they have to abide by. And I don't know how people there even remember all of these laws. Life shouldn't be like this, like in any country. Like, you shouldn't have to live like this. So I'm going to go through a number of laws there and how things work. So playing music in public is illegal, as is dancing or singing. Alcohol is completely illegal across the country, and if you're caught with alcohol or under the influence of alcohol, you'll either go to prison, a massive fine, or you'll get lashings. You'll be sentenced to lashings. So keep that in mind for this particular case. Adultery is illegal, but generally that law only applies to women who are cheating on men. So those women usually get sentenced to like 80 lashings. Keep that in mind for this case. Children are indoctrinated in schools, and in that documentary, it has them talking to a little boy and he's reading from his state authorized textbook. And that's kind of in that trailer I played to you. And he's basically saying, like, Jews are the devil, Christians are the devil, like, women, you know, fucking men are better than women. So, yeah, and those textbooks are popping up, like, across the world. So people, you know, I know this shit's happening in, like, France and the United Kingdom. Even though tourism is now kind of a thing, although I think you'd have to be mad to actually go there for a holiday, why would you? Tourists can expect to have their devices looked through upon arrival in Saudi Arabia. Concerts are a relatively new thing, but you cannot sing or dance at them. Movies are banned and there are no cinemas. Porn is banned, and as is sexting or sending like a kind of sexy text to someone. Dating is also banned. You don't date before marriage. The marriage is set up and then you have sex after you get married. And there is no minimum age limit for marriage. So that's why Mohammed bin Salman is saying like that he'd get rid of child marriage, but that hasn't happened yet. I often look up like how countries approach giving birth and periods, because I always find like you can tell a lot about a country by that. So I found out that to give birth, you must present your marriage certificate as a woman. So you won't get help with that kind of thing if your husband's not there, and men aren't allowed to be there in the same room anyway. I found this study about young girls, like in their periods, girls in their teens. And basically it said that lies and these weird religious myths about periods are still getting perpetuated in Saudi Arabia. So a lot of girls are like told, you know, to avoid contact with men, not to shower, to avoid certain drinks and foods and things. That the like the education around female issues and periods and things like that in Saudi Arabia is pretty much like non-existent. And it's because a lot of women, they don't want to approach men, so the men are responsible for buying them tampons and things like that, because women have to ask the man to go buy it for them, and they don't want to, like, because of that. You're not supposed to legally talk to men about things like that. So they're in like a catch 22 where like they're pretty much fucked, and they have to like ask like an older woman from the family, if there is one, like for help. Being gay or trans is illegal in Saudi Arabia, the most illegal it can be. They'll torture you to death. In March 2017, two transgender people were shoved in bags, beaten with sticks and tortured to death. There's no PDAs in Saudi Arabia, no holding hands, no hugging, no kissing, nothing like that. Those are, so basically from a young age, they are taught that anyone who's not their super strict code of Islam are seen as evil. Christians in this part of the world have been beheaded or driven out or tortured to death. Even like less radical Muslims, Shia Muslims, are considered the enemy, which you'll see in that documentary. There are 10 million migrant workers in Saudi Arabia, and they have to, God knows why they have to, they go there, but they're actually escaping like poverty and famine and stuff in other countries. There's a lot of Ethiopians working in Saudi Arabia. So once they're there, they have to stay under a sponsorship program from an employer. And usually this is like menial labor where they get really mistreated. So basically once you're in that sponsorship program, your employer is like God to you. It's kind of like the male-female relationship. So you pretty much rely on your employer for everything. You cannot go anywhere or leave the country without permission from that employer, and they'll pretty much just take your passport away. So labor abuses and pretty much slave labor are widespread. The education system from a very young age basically keeps the lie going. They make kids from a very young age very paranoid about the outside world. So as they say in that documentary, it just kind of, it's a snowball effect where every generation is pretty much going through school being almost radicalized against the rest of the outside world, creating like a widespread kind of hateful society. And then, you know, the crown prince knows that, you know, you're going to have coming up generations who will keep this system going. So, yeah, I was just going to say that Saudis, and they talk a lot in the documentary about it, but Saudis are often more radicalized than any other country because of their strict code of Islam. And they, Saudis have been responsible for some of the most notorious terrorist attacks in history, including the 9/11 attacks. And they also said in the documentary, which didn't surprise me, that Saudis make up a large percentage of ISIS. A lot of them go and join it because they've been so radicalized. People very much live in fear in Saudi Arabia, and if you're lucky enough to escape, most countries, I guess, will grant you asylum. The prisons are overcrowded, they're chaotic, lawless. The hidden cameras showed prisoners bashing other inmates, prisoners sleeping on the ground on concrete, injecting heroin into their arms. The British government actually gave Saudi Arabia millions of dollars a couple of years ago to get them to reform their prison systems, but Saudi Arabia cancelled the deal. Executions. So you may remember I just said that when Mohammed bin Salman came in, he said that he was going to reform capital punishment and he was going to kind of phase it out. So I just want to say that executions under him are the highest they have been in decades. And on the documentary, there's actually a hidden camera that shows a woman being bashed to death in the street by an authority figure while other authorities and police officers stand around and watch, like it's some sort of medieval television, because, you know, maybe this is still like a form of entertainment for them. I know, you know, that's tons to go through, but I just, there's not a lot good I can say about this place, and I really tried. These days things have changed a little bit just in the last couple of years, and I think that really was from international pressure. I don't know why tourists would go there. You would have to be insane. Apparently in the next 10 years they want to have 100 million people visiting there. Like, you would have to be nuts. They've kind of relaxed tourist expectations, so women really had to cover themselves, like, up until recently if they wanted to go there as a tourist. But now they're saying that women don't have to wear the full cloak. I can't remember what it's called that women there wear, but they do still have to cover themselves. It's actually really sickening when you see footage of women there with the cloak on, covering their whole body and their whole face. And then you just see men walking around in jeans and t-shirts. Like, there's, you just got to wonder, like, what women really think there. But I guess you're never going to get that answer because they're so controlled, and most of them will live birth to death in Saudi Arabia, you know. But there's got to be people like in North Korea who question this stuff, even though they don't have access to outside movies to see how things really, you know, happen in other countries. You know that there's people who are like, yeah, something's fucked here and I've got to get out. Like that young girl, Rahaf, who got asylum in Canada, because there's intelligent people and educated people everywhere who would have to go, this is not the way that the rest of the world is living. And we're right next to Dubai, where people are on beaches and tourists are on beaches in bikinis and things. And, you know, what's going on, like, but yeah, I just thought I'd go through like a bit of the human rights abuses there and laws, because in Helen's case, really the police looked over the fact that two people died and really just focused on the laws that were being broken. And I think that's kind of a good indicator that they really don't care why something happened or how something happened. They're more interested in the circumstances surrounding what happened. So I guess you're intrigued as to what happened. So let's get into Helen's death in Saudi Arabia. So when Helen got to Saudi Arabia, she was living in the city of Jeddah, which is the second biggest city in Saudi Arabia behind the country, Riyadh. And she'd only been there for about 6 months before she unfortunately died. So Helen moved there on December 5th, 1978. But you have to remember that Saudi Arabia has since relaxed some things. But in 1979, when she died, tourists really, or expats, because they weren't tourists, you had to have a reason to go there, which was a job. They had to pretty much abide by most of the same laws as Saudi women, including the company you could keep, how you conducted yourself. You'll see. So her mum, Gerald, recently, just a few years ago, told the Daily Mail about how Helen ended up in Saudi Arabia. So she said, quote, "All my children are strong-willed and independent, and Helen was no exception. When she saw an advert in the newspaper for British nurses to work in Jeddah, she thought it would be a new experience. I was a bit apprehensive, but encouraged her to spread her wings. I remember her telling me her father did not approve and did not want her to go, and I said, it's your life, you do what you want. The last time I saw her was at Heathrow Airport when I went to see her off. As she left, she just smiled and said, bye, see you. In her letters, she told me she didn't think much of the place, but said she'd make lots of new friends and was enjoying trying out new things such as scuba diving, unquote. Apparently scuba diving is like a pastime there because it seems to come up again and again. But she said that Helen really didn't think much of Saudi Arabia because it was probably even more dirty. You should have seen this documentary with the hidden cameras, just feces, you know, in just no septic tanks, anything like that, just shit in the streets. And that's now. So there is another victim in this case, and his name was Johan Otten, and he was Dutch, and he was living in Saudi Arabia at the time. Some sources refer to him as Helen's boyfriend. Some refer to him not as Helen's boyfriend, but I believe he was Helen's boyfriend. He was 35, and he died alongside Helen. So unfortunately, there's not one picture out there of Johan Otten. He kind of became a secondary figure in all of this, and I'm not sure if it's because his family in the Netherlands bought the Saudi Arabia's official narrative that this was all a terrible accident, but he probably didn't have the voice behind the campaign like Helen did her father Ron. But there's just nothing from his family ever after this happened, and there's not one picture either. He was actually like a tugboat captain, and I'm not sure if there's not a picture because of his job. I'm not entirely sure. There's a couple of photos of Helen, one with her siblings and one on her own, but actually the people where there's the most pictures are the two relatively rich people that we'll be talking about, whose house the party was held at. So Helen was employed at a hospital in Jeddah called the Baksh Hospital in the spring of 1979. And she had kind of made friends with a couple there who were in their early 30s. So it was Dr. Richard Arnett, who was a surgeon he was an expat surgeon. He was British. Living in Saudi Arabia at the time, and she probably met him and his wife, Penny, through the hospital that she was working at. So Helen had become quite close with Penny Arnett. They refer to Penny as a socialite and the wife of surgeon Richard Arnett. And they had two young children, the Arnetts. And it says in a couple of sources that Helen actually had babysat their two young children and been to their apartment a couple of times. And it was quite a nice apartment, a sixth floor apartment in a good part of Jeddah. I don't know where Helen lived, probably like in provided accommodations, like with other nurses. But these two, it seems like, were quite high rollers in the expat community. And there's quite a lot of pictures of them like sitting in their apartment being interviewed, like smoking cigarettes, and they look quite like they would have been quite like a glitzy couple. So the notorious party where all of this would happen was held on the night of May 19th, 1979, going into May 20th, 1979. So they had this kind of rowdy party where different people's stories kind of are different as to what happened. But one thing we know for sure is that there was alcohol there. Now, as you will remember, alcohol is strictly forbidden in the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. Bringing it in, even coming in on a plane where you've had a couple of drinks, is illegal. And of course, there's always going to be a black market for this kind of stuff because it's bought in from other countries, probably Kuwait, which is nearby. But there was alcohol served at this party at the Arnett's, and there was homemade wine, gin, and black market whiskey. Now, there was quite a lot of like homemade stuff back then because this episode of Locked Up Abroad, I remember with a male nurse going there in like the 90s, said that there was a lot of like bootleg alcohol available. But I think people were like quite drunk at this party, which I think you'll come to realize too. So the guests at the party, this is a very controversial issue because many believe that a lot of people who attended the party were never on the official documentation from police, and they never said that they were there. And the reason for this was that they were Saudi Arabian locals who would have got into serious shit under Sharia law for being there in the presence of alcohol and people doing kind of naughty stuff. So we do know that the party was for a young New Zealand scuba diver Tim Hayter, who had been living in Saudi Arabia at the time. I've never been able to find him again, just letting you know. And it was a going away party because he was leaving Saudi Arabia. There was also a French marine biologist there called Jacques Texier. There was Helen, her boyfriend, who was a tugboat captain, Johan, and six German scuba divers who were kind of friendly with Tim Hayter. Now, most people presume that there was a number of other guests there who were local Saudis who have never been identified. So on the night of May 19th into the early hours of May 20th, 1979, the Arnotts threw this going away party for Tim Hayter, who brought along some people, and then there was other people. So according to official British and Saudi statements, there were no other guests at this party. But later on, British newspapers who interviewed Tim Hayter and Jacques Texier and a number of other people, they reported that there were other guests there that included five other nurses, Saudi and British diplomats who were in Jeddah at the time, and even the son of a former CIA chief in Saudi Arabia, who reportedly was also working for the CIA at the time. So you can see why these people may have not been added to the official things, and other people may not have like given them up. But I'm sure that for the most part, the people who didn't make the list, and I guarantee there were people who didn't make the list, were fearful of getting into trouble, getting sentenced to lashings, going to prison, losing their jobs, things like that. So people are having drinks and whatever's going on is going on. And, you know, most people have been very secretive about what happened. So according to most sources, at 2 a.m., Dr. Arnott, Richard Arnott, he went to bed because he had to perform an operation in the morning. So I'm glad that he's been drinking and living it up and staying up really late when he has to perform an operation as a surgeon. So he went to bed and the rest of the partygoers kind of continued on drinking. So according to most sources, including the Saudi official reports from police who did an investigation into this when it happened, no one heard anything or saw anything weird for the rest of the night. But at around sunrise on the morning of the 20th, 1979, the bodies of Helen and Johan were found underneath the apartment. So they had fallen from the sixth floor apartment. And if you're a patron, I'll put up the picture of the apartment block. It's very tall. So she and Johan had actually fallen 23 metres, which is about 70 feet. So it is a massive fall, even though it's only six floors. Now, from kind of what I can see, and it's a black and white photo and it's not very good, it actually shows like that the balconies had like almost like an internal railing system on them. So, and it's very tall. So that's one of the first things that is kind of an issue for people who didn't believe this full story, because there's just, when you look at it, it's pretty much impossible that someone would have accidentally fallen off the balcony. So I'll put that picture up for Patreons, to see, but yeah, it's just, it's literally impossible. So that's the first problem. So Helen was on the ground, and kind of next to her on railings on the ground floor was Johan, and he had been like impaled on these railings. He had like fallen and pretty much caught the railings and been impaled. And I don't know what part of his body was impaled, and I don't want to know. So according to the Telegraph, Johan was referred to as partly clothed. So he didn't have his pants on. Pants for the Brits, I know you guys call underwear pants, so I mean trousers. And his underwear was around his thigh, according to the Telegraph. Now, according to Marxism Today, my favourite source from 1983, quote, he was found impaled on the railings below the balcony of the Arnott's flat, face down and trouserless, his head most probably towards the building, showing that he fell over backwards, unquote. So he hadn't actually made it down to the floor, the ground, but Helen had, and she'd fallen like 70 feet, which is a huge amount. And when you consider the likelihood that she would probably break every bone in her body. I want you to like kind of keep that in mind for when we get into the postmortems, because they would ultimately, Helen would be put through like 6 initial postmortem examinations, including back in the UK, because her father Ron like demanded it. So Helen had, she had bruises on the inside of her thighs, and she had damage to her head. Helen did not have one break or fracture of her entire body for falling 70 feet, which obviously is like near impossible. So I'm going to read to you from one of the postmortems. Quote, Helen Smith's left arm was fixed in rigor mortis in a raised position above her head. If she had died where she was found, the arm could not have stayed elevated like that. Her face and head were covered in bruises, and microscopic examination showed them to have been sustained in life. One of them, the result of a heavy blow to the top of the head, had caused a bleed on the surface of the brain, which would have produced almost instant unconsciousness. And as Ron Smith's counsel pointed out, an unconscious person cannot get up and fall over a balcony. And there were bruises to the genitals and inner thighs, typical of sexual assault, unquote. So Helen, I know rigor sets in within a few hours and only lasts for a few hours. So it seems like this had happened probably 3 or 4 hours ago. So this is a quote from somebody from when she had a post-mortem examination when her body was returned to the UK. So Helen's entire face and head were covered in bruises like she had been bashed, which is what the British professionals believe. So ultimately her death was caused by a really hard blow to the top of her head. So if you believe that that was caused by the fall, it means that Helen literally like was upside down, perfect, like a diver, and landed smack bang on her head. But we all know that the damage and the number of breaks and fractures caused by a fall like that would be like catastrophic. She probably would have broken like almost every bone in her body, including her skull, but that just didn't happen. But ultimately, this blow to the top of her head caused an instant brain bleed that ultimately killed her. And they said all of this happened while she was alive. Now, the bruises to the genitals thing. So I was recently like reading a study about how it's very hard to prove that somebody was raped because, without going into too much detail, like it's what is rough consensual sex to one person, like as an adult, it can show up as the same thing. But in this particular case with Helen, it says that she had bruises to the genitals and her inner thigh bruises were like someone was like grabbing at her inner thighs. Do you know what I mean? And this all kind of indicates that it wasn't consensual, and it also all happened like around the same time. Now, her entire right side were like very bruised all right down her right side. And her, as I said, her inner thighs were bruised, and also in the middle of her forehead, there was a deep indent, and they didn't know like what caused that. But what they did know is that she should have like broken a lot of bones, and there was not one break or fracture from falling 70 feet. And it is a huge distance to fall. Now, even her skull wasn't fractured, like keep that in mind. So Helen's family were obviously notified back in Yorkshire, and Gerald told the Daily Mail how she was told, because the police arrived at her door to tell her that Helen had died, and she just collapsed like on the spot. She told the Daily Mail, quote, Ron blamed me for Helen's death, saying that if I hadn't encouraged her to go to Saudi, she never would have died, unquote. So I don't think Gerald went out to Saudi Arabia, but Ron did. And remember, he was a police officer and he'd seen probably quite a lot of stuff. He flew to Saudi Arabia 4 days after Helen died, and he identified her in the morgue. And the first thing that struck him was that she fell all of that way and she didn't break one bone. Like, he'd seen a lot of shit when he was a cop and he'd never heard of something like that. So he was immediately like, whatever they are saying happened isn't right, because basically at this point the Saudis started pushing their own theory that this was all a terrible accident, and that Helen and Johan had been having sex on the balcony, like on the ledge, and fallen over. But when you look at the picture of the balcony, you'll know that's literally not possible, on top of the fact that Helen just doesn't have the right injuries consistent with a fall of 70 feet. So as he was leaving the hospital after identifying Helen, Ron said that friends of Helen, who he didn't name, approached him and told him that she had been murdered and that it was not an accident. So after their very brief investigation, Saudi police decided that this was all a terrible accident. Helen and Johan had been having sex and fallen. Johan had unfortunately been impaled, and Helen had fallen the full extent, and all she had was bruises around her head, like she'd been bashed repeatedly, and, you know, fingerprint marks, like bruises on her inner thighs, vaginal bruising, and things that just don't make sense with a fall. Because, yeah, I was just going to say something really crude, but yeah. So they decided that those were accidental, but they were focusing on the party that had happened, obviously, because we've already talked about how strict Saudi Arabia is and alcohol is banned. And so they decided to zone in on that and what happened at the party, not the deaths, just the alcohol and other things. So Saudi police charged the Arnetts with serving alcohol, which was a serious offence at the time in the Dry Country. And they were both arrested, Richard and Penny, on the 24th of March, 1980. So kind of like almost a year later, once the investigation had gone on. Ultimately, Richard Arnett, the surgeon whose house it was with his wife, he received a year in prison and was sentenced to 30 lashes for hosting the party, having the guests, having alcohol there, and having males and females who weren't married or related in the same room. And Penny was sentenced to 80 lashes. Now, I guess you're wondering why Penny was sentenced to 80 lashes and Richard only 30 and a year in prison. So ultimately, the French marine biologist, when he was questioned, had said that after Richard Arnett went to bed at 2 a.m., Penny had had sex with Tim Hayter, who was the guy whose going away party it was, the Kiwi guy. And so she was charged with adultery in that country, which is a serious thing, because she cheated on Richard with Tim, even though, who knows, they could have had they could have been swinging or had an open relationship, but excuses like that in Saudi Arabia don't matter. So the Arnetts ultimately would spend 5 months in jail, and another 9 months under house arrest. And ultimately their lashings were never carried out. At one stage, Penny Arnett actually faced being stoned to death, because that was the going sentence for adultery. That was when she confessed to it, but she retracted her statement confessing when they told her that she would face being stoned to death. Do you honestly think, in an actual forward-thinking society, that stoning a woman to death for having an affair is, a normal reaction? It's not. So the Arnetts ultimately were allowed to return to Britain because the British government intervened and they were quite kind of highly regarded people. They never had the lashings carried out, and obviously they left Saudi Arabia like you would stay there after all that had happened. And I think Richard Arnett kind of confessed to not knowing how strict the country was in regards to alcohol. I think he probably thought they'd kind of let it go because we're well-heeled kind of expats, but I think they had the wrong idea of what kind of country this was. So by this stage, people who had attended the party, who were on the official list, had come forward to say that there was a fight of some description and that it was a murder, and we don't have any other details other than that. So Ron Smith refused to believe the official explanation that they'd fallen while having sex, and he launched his own investigation. So he had Helen's body sent home to the UK, and there were three separate postmortems, and Ron paid for all these because they had to be paid for by him. And those are the ones I read to you from one just a little bit earlier. So Saudi Arabia had retained Helen's vital organs as part of an ongoing investigation that they'd clearly closed, but it makes no sense. So she didn't have any of her vital organs. And so these kind of independent examinations went along without Helen's organs. But ultimately, the independent examinations said that the experts said that Helen couldn't have possibly died from a fall, which we've already gone through. They said that the bruises on her body actually were in line with being beaten to death and then kind of taken downstairs and placed on the ground to make it look like she'd fallen, which actually makes more sense. So on the 16th of December 1979, the Home Office pathologist, Dr. Michael Green, who did the initial autopsy, because so when she was returned, they had to do like a government autopsy. And then on top of that, there were two additional ones paid for by Ron. So Dr. Michael Green from the Home Office said, quote, "If I was to say Helen Smith's death was an accident, I would be a liar," unquote. So despite all of this, the authorities wouldn't hold an inquest. So basically, we've talked about inquests before, which are pretty commonplace under like a Westminster system, generally in Commonwealth countries. And generally, an inquest is an automatic thing when you die abroad. But actually, like, the British authorities were able to just say, "Nah, we don't want to do it." And that was the end of that. So Ron repeatedly tried to get this inquest going, because when an inquest is held by a coroner, it can actually kind of get the wheels in motion for criminal charges to be brought. So this went on for like years. And the coroner at the time, who was a guy called Philip Gill, he refused to do an inquest. Now, I don't think this is like a corrupt thing. I just think he couldn't be fucked. I don't think he was connected at all to Saudi Arabia, but I think he was just like, well, it's already clearly like what they've said, it was an accident. But he basically said that because Helen had died abroad, he didn't feel like he had to do an inquest. Now, this was completely against the actual law, which stated that British law does not prevent an inquest in the instance that someone dies overseas. So technically, he should have been doing one. Now, basically, Ron was fucking jack with all this shit. He was like, nah, they're all fucking corrupt and fuck this. What do I pay my taxes for? So Ron just stopped paying his taxes, and he was forced to go to court for not paying his taxes. And at court, he publicly accused the Arnott couple of murdering Helen. And the newspapers suddenly were all over it, because it was all very controversial that Ron hadn't paid his taxes and then had an outburst at court. So he had accused the couple whose house it was or apartment it was when Helen died of murdering Helen, which is very... it's a big jump, because we know that when Richard went to bed, Penny Arnott had sex with Tim Hader, whose going away party it was, and cheated on her husband. But it's a really big leap for me from that to the couple killing Helen, who was a guest at the party. And there were like scores of guests at the party. So it's kind of a big jump for me. But basically, they would interview people who had been at the party who had since left Saudi Arabia and who would all corroborate the theory that there was some sort of fight and that Helen had been the target and Johan had been trying to protect her from this attack. So there was a magazine called Private Eye back in the day, and it was kind of like satire, and that one reported that Helen had been raped and murdered by the German divers, and that Johan Otten had been beaten and stabbed to death, and that was all like a complete lie and not in line with what happened. So ultimately, they started getting traction in the case, because Johan Otten had a life insurance policy back in the Netherlands, and the life insurance company got wind of what Ron was trying to achieve, and they decided that they were not going to pay out Johan's life insurance policy to his family until basically they had a clearer idea of what happened. So they basically had their investigators interview the German divers who had been at the party who Tim Hayter had brought along. And these German divers, they claimed in this interview with the life insurance company of the Netherlands that both Johan Otten and Helen Smith had been killed after, quote unquote, a terrible fight. So basically, due to all of this, Ron Smith finally got his inquest, which legally should have happened anyway. The Court of Appeal overturned Coroner Gill's ruling that he wasn't going to do one. And in 1982, Ron got his inquest. Now, basically, all of the doctors had to come who had done, you know, post-mortems on Helen when she'd been returned to the UK. And we heard from one of those testimonies earlier about kind of the damage to her body and how it wasn't consistent with a fall of that height. But they basically had to speak again at this inquest and reiterated, two out of three of them reiterated that Helen had died violently. But they disagreed about whether she'd actually fallen from the sixth floor balcony after this violent altercation. So Leeds pathologist Michael Green, who had done one of the independent analysis, he said that the condition of Helen's body was that of, quote, the typical victim of rape, unquote. He added, quote, my findings are consistent with her being beaten and I accept that she could have been pushed off the balcony, unquote. So another pathologist who had also done an independent one paid for by Ron Smith agreed about the injuries to Helen's body. He said that Helen could have only survived for a few minutes after that blow to the top of her head, which ultimately caused a massive brain bleed, killing her. He said that the balcony was more than 20... Sorry, but the balcony was pretty much the height of the balcony from the ground. He said, quote, no human being could fall that distance and sustain such light injuries, unquote. So again, he's saying her injuries just aren't consistent with a fall of that magnitude. So ultimately, the ruling wasn't what Ron Smith wanted. They returned like an open ruling that they weren't sure what had happened. But basically, one of the good things about this whole thing was that it changed the law that imposed a duty. A duty on coroners so that they had to investigate deaths abroad when the body was returned to England and Wales. So they couldn't just do what Gill had done and say, no, I don't want to do one. It meant that they had to do an inquest into deaths abroad. So it's very much in line with similar kind of cases that we've talked about, like Carolyn Abel in the US, that meant that people can be prosecuted for crimes that happen overseas, but in the United States, very similar, like people put enough pressure on and this happens. So basically, this was really high profile. They called it the inquest of the century in the UK, which shows kind of the magnitude. And ultimately, this ruling that meant that they had to do a inquest after returning them to England or Wales actually meant it was actually the reason why Princess Di, when she died and was returned from Paris to England, actually had an independent inquest as well. So there's a lot of good things that have come out of that. But ultimately, the open finding meant, yeah, we don't really know what happened. Like, we can't say this and we can't say that. The coroner himself, Gill, who basically didn't do his job initially, he said he didn't do the inquest initially because he felt like they fell having sex, like what the Saudi authorities had said. His theory was that basically they fell while having sex and Johan, his body impaling on a railing deflected Helen's fall. So it kind of cushioned her so that when she did fall, she didn't have the same injuries as someone who fell that whole distance without ricocheting off someone. I know, it's all very crazy. So for many years, Gerald, Helen's mum, believed that Ron Smith was keeping all this up and keeping all this going, to kind of like get back at her for leaving him and things like that. And initially she said that she believed that it was all a terrible accident, but it took a couple of decades and she finally came around to the idea that Ron was probably right and that she started having her suspicions. Now, one of the big things about this case that kind of makes it monumental in British history is that Ron Smith would not allow Helen's body to be buried until this was all wrapped up And ultimately, she would be the longest held body in British history in a morgue. She was held at Leeds General Infirmary for 30 years until she was finally buried. And that was when Ron finally relented. And I have really mixed feelings about this because I don't know why Ron gets to call the shots on that. That kind of makes me pretty angry. It really disturbed Gerald and the other siblings that he just wouldn't allow Helen to be buried. Part of me finds him very admirable that he went ahead and did this. And I know in my heart of hearts that part of why Ron was fighting Francis for Helen was because I feel like he felt like him and his violence had kind of driven Gerald away and broken up their family. And he was kind of atoning for things that he had done. And that's kind of what I think, even though he didn't say it and Gerald didn't say it. But I don't know why in this instance Ron would not allow her to be buried, because they already had so many tests done and photographs and things written down. There's really no need to have her body still there. And I also don't understand why Ron gets to make that decision, because she also had a mother, and I don't know why that's allowed to happen. And kind of makes me angry. But then part of me is Ron is not allowing her to be put in the ground until, you know, he has answers. Now, as I said, for a long time, Gerald felt that Ron's refusal to allow Helen to be laid to rest was a vendetta against Gerald. But I think, ultimately, it really wasn't. But she was frightened for 30 years to ask Ron to allow them to finally bury Helen. But finally, she wrote, you know, just about 15 years ago to Ron. And she said, look, we're both getting older. We'll be dead soon. And we need to bury Helen while we're both still alive. Please, let us bury them. And she was really shocked because Ron wrote back and actually relented and let them bury her. And Helen was finally cremated with a service in November 2009, after she'd laid at the hospital in Leeds for 30 years. And her ashes were scattered on Ilkley Moor, which is the one that I mentioned at the start that she loved as a child. And it was actually the first time that the kids had seen Ron for a very long time, because they were all estranged from him. So I guess I've gone through the theories, but to recap, I really think there's two theories in this. And those are as follows. And I guess it depends on whose side of the story and who you believe. So the first theory is that Helen and Johan were killed as some sort of fight in the apartment, and their bodies, Helen's body was placed at the foot of the apartment to make it look like she fell, and Johan was pushed off the balcony and impaled, because there's no other way to kind of impale him without pushing him off the balcony. So that's the one theory. And the next one is that Helen and Johan, the Saudi authorities say, fell from the balcony while having sex, which explains why Johan doesn't have any. So I really can't ignore science in this case, and the fact that Helen had to have had breaks and injuries and things like that. And I can't buy Coroner Gill's theory that she ricocheted off Johan. Johan being impaled kind of indicates that he fell, because they couldn't have done that otherwise. But I think just even looking at the pictures of the apartment, there's just no way he could have fallen over. There's the balcony, and then there's a higher privacy fencing within. And I just can't see how you would fall without being lifted up and pushed over, if you know what I mean. I can't see how anyone would be having sex against that either. I don't know. I don't know how the Saudi authorities kind of missed major red flags like that. I don't know what happened. I kind of have a funny feeling that there was some sort of swinging going on. I'm not saying there was a massive orgy going on, but or Helen walked in on Penny Arnott having sex with the other guy, and kind of, you know, she kind of went to leave, I'm going to tell someone, and something happened. Any number of things could happen. And also there was a lot of guests that were never officially listed on the documentation. So I can't kind of begin to fathom what happened, but I have to presume that Johan was pushed off the balcony in some capacity. And I have to go with science that Helen was carried downstairs and placed there, you know, like she had fallen, but she actually hadn't. Maybe someone at the apartment was trying to like get physical with Helen, which kind of explains the bruising and her inner thighs and things like that. And Johan intervened, which I actually think is probably the case. And that's what Ron thought as well. Ron believed up until his death that Johan died trying to stop Helen's murder or rape. And it was covered up. And I can't tell you how I think that happened, but I do think that's what happened. And there's just no way these days, because this is pretty much closed. It was such a long time ago to know who did it, what happened. But I firmly believe that the hosts knew what happened, and they should be the people that have the answers. And they're getting older now, so, you know, I don't know. But I'm going to tell you what happened to each of the people, you know, now. So ultimately, Gerald, Helen's mum, emigrated to the USA in the last kind of decades of her life, and I believe that she's still alive, although the most recent update was like 10 years ago. So David and Graham, Helen's brothers, have never spoken publicly about Helen's death. They don't really get their feelings out there, but actually Beverly, her younger sister, spoke to the Daily Mail after Helen was finally put to rest. And it's the first time that she'd ever spoken publicly about Helen's death. So she said, quote, "During the past few weeks, there have been so many ups and downs, and I've run the whole gamut of emotions, but it was all worth it. After the funeral service, I spent a few minutes alone with Helen. I touched her coffin and said, 'We did it, sis. It's taken a long time, but we did it.' I was the one who looked after Helen's ashes that night after the funeral, and to be honest, I didn't want to let her go. I wanted to keep her with me, but scattering her ashes on the moor was the right thing to do as a family. I spoke to my dad, and it felt good that it has all ended on a positive note after all these years." Unquote. Now, even at that time when they put Helen, scattered her ashes on Ilkley Moor, Ron would not allow Gerald or the siblings to have any photos of Helen, because all of the photos from her growing up had been left behind in the house when Gerald left, when Helen was like 21, and Ron was still holding on to those. Now, Ron died at the age of 83 in April 2011, and I believe Gerald is alive, and I hope that they got some of their photos of Helen. I know Penny remarried, from what I can find. I don't know if she would probably be dead now. She may not be. Richard Arnett is still alive. He wrote a book about this whole experience, which is out of print now, so I can't get it. It's called Arabian Nightmare, and it was published in 1999, so about 20 years after all this happened, and I'd be interested to read it to see his version of events, because his version of events is pretty much like, I went to bed and I don't know what happened, and then someone found them at sunrise, and I don't know what happened, and then this is all the stuff that happened to me. So that would be the whole story, like about how he spent time in prison, house arrest and things like that. So I do have the blurb of it though, about who he is, to give you an idea of what happened to Richard Arnett. So, quote, "Richard Arnett was born in England in 1941. He is a fellow of the Royal College of Surgeons of Edinburgh and a fellow of the Royal Australasian College of Surgeons. He practices in rural New South Wales and represents rural surgeons on the Australian Association of Surgeons Board," unquote. So yes, indeed, he ended up in Australia. He'd be 80 this year. So from what I can find, he is still alive, because he's still listed on quite a lot of kind of surgeons board's website. There was a episode of the show Australian Story in 2000 featuring Richard Arnett talking about his experience. I cannot find that episode. So from what I can find, Richard lives in northern New South Wales. When him and Penny split, he remarried another woman and had another child. And the other two Arnett kids that were quite young, and I guess if anything happened, they would have heard it, in the USA, and that's where they ultimately ended up living, which is funny because that's where Gerald ultimately ended up living. So this is one where I really want to know what you guys think. Email unknownpassagepodcast@gmail.com, or if you're a patron, write it on the post that I will put up for this episode once you look at the pictures that are associated with this. I really want to know what you guys think once you've kind of had a think about it, the process of what happened. If any of you are really good with sciencey stuff or work in this field, what kind of we know what killed Helen, but what kind of do the bruises and injuries to her body kind of indicate, you know, what happened to her? Johan didn't have all those bruises and things. Ultimately, his cause of death was he fell and was impaled on railings, which is just a horrible, horrible thing. But actually, that's the thing that I remembered when Paul chose Saudi Arabia. I was like, yeah, I remember someone being impaled and a gathering that wasn't supposed to happen, and things like that. I do have other cases that I want to do at some point, including Yvonne Guilford in Saudi Arabia. This is a case that I think in this instance, even though a lot of people tried to make Ron look paranoid and like he was chasing after a ghost, I think in this instance, Ron was right. And maybe because he was a cop and he'd kind of seen these things before, not just because it was his daughter. I think he was right, like when he'd looked at her body, and that's why he funded additional kind of independent pathologists, and they all came to the same conclusion, which they said at the inquest, that it's just not possible that she fell and that someone placed her there. And it has to be someone from the apartment. I don't know if people had left by that point, who was still there. It seems like the Saudis like didn't get an answer from people as to exactly who was there and who left, who arrived when and who left when, because everyone was too scared. This is the thing, like how strict they are. This is a good indicator of like why that's not good, because people are too scared to tell you the truth about who was at a fucking party having a glass of wine. Like, can we be real for a second? So yeah, finally, please don't, now that they've got tourist visas, go there. I'll be very mad at you if you do go to Paris or Rome. There is nothing to see in Saudi Arabia except the destruction of people's lives and just probably women being decapitated in the middle of the street. If you think I'm like making out like this happens all the time, it actually does. Like, do more research into this fucking place, and don't give to their tourism because they already make enough money. So yeah, that's it. Let me know what you think. The website is back up. It's unknownpassagepodcast.com. Leave a rating or a review if you like the show on your podcast platform of choice. Unfortunately, right now, the only way to do that, I think, is Apple Podcasts. Become a patron. You get to choose a location for an upcoming episode. And this one was for Paul. So thank you, Paul. You can pretty much, any amount that you give per month that are on the different tiers, you are entitled to that. And I add you to the list. So usually it takes a couple of months for me to get around to you, but it has to be after your first month has finished. And give one-off donations towards the website and costs of doing this podcast to unknownpassagepodcast@gmail.com on PayPal. That would be amazing because things are not good here. So next week I have patron Amy coming up, but before that I will also be dropping you a bonus episode that I hope you enjoy. And yeah, I think that's pretty much it. So yeah, the bonus episode, I'll be bringing on a friend of mine. We have to record it later on this week, and I just thought it would be a really interesting topic to do and person to bring on. So yeah, thank you so much for listening. Let me know what you think about this case, what you think about Helen, Johan, Penny, Richard. Yeah, I guess I could just pick up the phone and ring Richard if I know where he lives. But I won't be doing that. So yeah, thanks so much. And I'll be back next week with a new episode. I have, my results for my nuclear scan on my neck that I had last week. So I'll probably have that, the results back by the time I record the next full episode. So I will let you guys know if it's, you know, goiter, Graves' disease, thyroid cancer, who fucking knows? And I'll be very relieved to have those results because it's kind of been ruining my life. So I will talk to you then. Okay, bye.